Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for dropping along tonight, where Dr. Daniel Pipes makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. I think it's probably his fourth occasion here. Now, I'll introduce our speaker very briefly. He has a PhD in history from Harvard University, currently president of the Middle East Forum. He's a commentator. He's the author of 16 books, and his website is danielpipes.org. I should say thanks to the Australia, Israel and Jewish Affairs Council for making this function possible tonight. And our speaker is going to speak for us on the topic of Europe or Eurabia, Islam and the continent's future. Dr. Pipes, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you, Gerald, and good evening, everyone. It's a delight to be back. And I'd like to take up a topic that is very au courant, Europe and its future. There are really two big issues in Europe. One is the European Union, and the other are the penumbra of issues around Islam. Jihad, all those issues concerning women, honor killing, female genital mutilation, burqas, niqabs, issues concerning alcohol, issues concerning Holocaust education, and on and on and on. I'm not a Europeanist, I'm a specialist on the Middle East, but I do follow closely the increasing place of Muslims in Europe and the response to them. I would argue to you that the future of Europe is in play. Will it turn into Eurabia, a part of the Muslim world, or will it remain the distinct cultural unit that it has been over the past millennium? Or might there be some creative synthesis between the two? The issue has vast importance. Europe was the motor force in the world for 500 years, from 1450 to 1950, from Henry the Navigator to the end of World War II. It was but 7% of the world's landmass, but dominant in science, economics, military affairs, politics, and so forth. How Europe goes has major implications. While it has lost that central motor force role, it is still vital, especially for those of us who live in daughter countries such as the United States and Australia. We combined have helped save the continent twice. We've been major allies with it for some 70 years. So which way will things go? I propose there are three possibilities. One is that everybody gets along in harmony and through integration. The second is Muslim domination. And the third is Muslims being rejected. I'd like to review these three arguments. The first is everybody gets along. Indigenous Europeans and immigrant Muslims live together harmoniously. This is, in fact, the default view of the establishment. Politicians, journalists, academics, and others. To give you one example, The Economist had a leader in mid-2006 in which it said the prospect of Eurabia looks like scaremongering. Within this view, there are two scenarios. The less optimistic holds that everyone will just muddle along. There'll be a modus vivendi that emerges. And the other is the more optimistic idea that there'll be a combination of two civilizations that will lead to something new and better. A good example of that was a study back in 1991 called La France, une chance pour l'Islam, in which the author said, for the first time in history, Islam is offered the chance to awaken in a democratic, rich, laic, and peaceable country. I'm hearing laughter. Okay. I would agree with the laughter. It requires Muslim acceptance of historic Europe. an acceptance which not only has not happened so far, but is increasingly unlikely. In particular, young Muslims are cultivating grievances and nursing ambitions at odds with their neighbors and contradicting this rosy scenario. Polls of British Muslims, for example, show the majority of them perceive conflict between their British and Muslim identities, and they want Islamic law, the Sharia, to be instituted. The possibility of Muslims accepting the confines of historic Europe and smoothly integrating within it can virtually be dismissed from consideration. Canadian novelist Hugh MacLennan dubbed his country's English-French split the Two Solitudes, and one sees something similar but far more pronounced developing in Europe. The American columnist Dennis Prager summed things up, quote, "It is difficult to imagine any other future scenario for Western Europe than its becoming Islamicized or having a civil war, i.e. my second and third scenarios." Or to take the case of Bassam Tibi, a Syrian Muslim who moved as a young man to Germany and became an eminent professor of the University of Göttingen, and he warned, "Either Islam gets Europeanized or Europe gets Islamized." He personally gave up on the continent some years ago, and after 44 years residence in Germany, he moved to the United States to take up a position at Cornell University. So I think one can put that aside as not likely, which leaves the two opposites. Either Muslims dominate or Muslims are rejected. Let me take up the Muslim dominating scenario. First, from the European vantage point, indigenous European vantage point, the distinguished left-wing Italian journalist and author, book author Oriana Fallaci, wrote in her second-to-last book, The Force of Reason, quote, "Europe becomes more and more a province of Islam, a colony of Islam," unquote. She was certain, that Christianity's ancient stronghold of Europe is rapidly giving way to Islam. Other important authors agree. For example, Batya Orr, the Swiss author, Mark Stein, the Canadian author, agree. Europe is finished. Islam will predominate. I'm not so sure. I'll give their argument, but I'm not so sure. First reason to think that the historic Europe is finished has to do with faith, the second with demography, and the third, a sense of heritage. When it comes to faith, Europe is extraordinary in its extreme secularism. Europe was a pious continent. It is no longer. It is what is called post-Christian. The number of observant Christians has dropped, has collapsed. London, for example, has many more Muslims in mosques on Friday than Christians in church on Sunday, though the population of Christians is many times greater than that of Muslims. There's an aggressive secularism that is unfamiliar to us as Americans and probably to you as Australians. It's particularly noteworthy among elites. There's an anger at Christianity and a sense that this is a source of evil. Christians who are looking at Europe tend to call it the new dark continent. And indeed, they're missionaries going to Europe from places like India, Korea, and Africa. Second point is about demography. Indigenous Europeans are not reproducing in sufficient numbers. Looking at the EU, the European Union, 28 countries now, in contrast to the total fertility rate, which is necessary to replicate one society, of 2.1 children per woman, the EU number is 1.6, and it's falling. The existing rate is just over two-thirds of what is needed to sustain a population. Put differently, one-third of Europeans have to come from elsewhere in order to sustain the economic machine, the pensions, and so forth. Should current population trends continue and immigration ceases, today's EU population of 508 million is projected to decline to about 400 million in some 50 years. To avoid the severe diminution of the population requires about 1.5 million people entering the EU every year. So secularism, demography, and identity. What is often called political correctness is, I think, something much deeper, namely the alienation of many Europeans from their heritage, a sense that their historic culture is not worth fighting for. Three items in particular, imperialism, racism, and fascism, dominate in the academy and elsewhere. This self-loathing can be traced back a century to World War I. A very self-confident Europe entered that war in 1914, and through the dark days of the Great War, the confident Europe found itself at the abyss and came out lacking that secure sense of self and purpose. And that has been exacerbated over the past centuries. Now, there are differences, of course. I'm speaking in grand generalities. France, for example, is far less prone to this self-hatred, and I'd say the UK and Sweden are champions in this regard. Now, from the Muslim point of view, let's look at those same three points. Faith, demography, and culture. The Muslim sensibility in Europe is completely opposite. As Christianity falters, Islam is robust, assertive, and ambitious. When combined with a jihadi sensibility, it leads many Muslims to see Europe as a continent ripe for conversion and domination. There are a whole range of wild supremacist claims. Let me just quote a couple of them. Omar Bakri Muhammad, a notorious British Islamist, said, "I want Britain to become an Islamic state. I want to see the flag of Islam raised at 10 Downing Street." Another notorious Islamist, British Islamist, said precisely the same thing about the White House and the flag of Islam, whatever that is, raised over the White House. Or the prediction of a Belgian-based imam, quote, "Soon we will take power in this country. Those who criticize us now will regret it. They will have to serve us. Prepare, for the hour is near," unquote. There are plenty of such very assertive statements. Fertility, demography. As you're probably aware, the Muslim fertility tends to be much higher. Now, there are exceptions. If one looks around the Middle East, there are plenty of places which have lower than replacement fertility. But the Muslims of Europe have, so far, had a much higher than replacement rate of reproduction. It's hard to give precise statistics. It is more anecdotal than statistical. But while it is really high, it is also quite clearly going down, but it is substantially more than the European birth rate. And of course, there's the ever continuing influx of immigrants, so that it is possible to imagine a Europe that is substantially Muslim. The Pew Foundation, the Pew Center, did a study recently, and it looked at high, middle, and low predictions of Muslim population in Europe. And for example, it came up with a statistic of nearly one-third, 30% of Sweden being Muslim in the foreseeable future. Amsterdam and Rotterdam are on the track to be Muslim-majority cities. And as a side note, I'm not really talking about Russia, but Russia with a 15% Muslim population that's indigenous, these are not immigrants, and a declining Orthodox Christian population could be heading in the same direction. The immigrants that are coming to Europe are disproportionately Muslim. This is due to several reasons. First, Muslim countries are close by. It's 75 kilometers from Albania to, and Albania is predominantly Muslim, to Italy. It is only 60 kilometers, believe it or not, from Tunisia to Italy. You're thinking there's a big Mediterranean, but there's a little island called Pantelleria, which is just off the coast of Tunisia. So you get there, you're in the EU. And it's just 13 kilometers from Morocco to Spain. So it's close. It's not hard to get to. Secondly, there are colonial ties, particularly the French to North Africa and the British to South Asia. And thirdly, there is a lot of violence, tyranny, and poverty in these Muslim countries. Think of Yemen and Libya and Syria, for starters, prompting waves of migration. So, faith, demography, and finally, culture. There is an interesting reversal. In the medieval period, Christians looking at Islam felt a disdain for Muslim life, and in particular, the sexual perversions that they perceived, polygamy in particular. Now it's the reverse. There are Muslim feelings of superiority that in substantial part, are based on sexual issues. There's a certain focus on pornography, divorce, homosexuality. Beyond these specifics, the Muslims who come to Europe have a sense that the Europeans don't feel pride. They're aware of the lack of European pride. Let me quote a British Muslim of Pakistani origins by the name of Atish Tasir. And he wrote an article called The British Jihadist, in which he said, quote, "Britishness is the most nominal aspect of identity to many young British Pakistanis. Britons themselves were having a hard time believing in Britishness. If you denigrate your own culture, you face the risk of your newer arrivals looking for one elsewhere." Unquote. So to sum up, this argument holds that Europe will be Islamized because the yin of Europe and the yang of Islam fit quite perfectly. Low and high religiosity, low and high fertility, low and high cultural confidence. In this view, Europe is an open door through which Muslims are walking through. And in this view, grand cathedrals will appear as vestiges of a prior civilization, at least until a Saudi-style regime transforms them into mosques, or a Taliban-like regime blows them up. That's view two. So first is everybody gets along, second, Islam prevails, and the third is that Muslims are rejected. The American columnist Ralph Peters dismissed the previous scenario. Quote, "Far from enjoying the prospect of taking over Europe by having babies, Europe's Muslims are living on borrowed time. Predictions of a Muslim takeover of Europe ignore history and Europe's ineradicable viciousness. Instead, he depicts Europe as a place, quote, that perfected genocide and ethnic cleansing, and he predicts that its Muslims will be lucky just to be deported and not killed." Claire Berlinski, another American author, wrote a book about Islam in Europe, Menace in Europe, implicitly agrees, pointing to the, quote, "ancient conflicts and patterns now shambling out of the mists of European history," unquote, which could well trigger violence. The main argument of this point of view is that Europeans are unhappy with the current trends and one day will wake up from their current stupor and demand nothing less than a reclaiming of their heritage. And indeed, one sees chafing, one sees unhappiness. Not so much among the elites who find multiculturalism attractive, but among the non-elites who find it problematic. So, in this spirit, legislation against burqas, that's the full covering, and niqabs, which allow the eyes, have passed in a number of countries now. France, Belgium, forget which else. In Switzerland, there was an anti-minaret referendum that passed 2-1 some years ago. Let me give you some examples of a survey from France. 67% say that Islamic values are incompatible with those of French society. 70% say there are too many foreigners. 73% view Islam negatively. 74% consider Islam intolerant. 84% are against the hijab, the headscarf, in private spaces, open to the public. And 86% are favorable to strengthening the ban on the burqa. As a result of this growing anti-immigration and in some sense, anti-Islamic sentiment, there has been a proliferation of political parties, just to mention a few. The Alternative for Germany in Germany, the National Front in France, Vlaams Belang in Belgium, the Party for Freedom in the Netherlands, the People's Party in Switzerland, the Freedom Party in Austria, the Northern League in Italy, the People's Party in Denmark, the Progress Party in Norway, the Sweden Democrats, the Finns Party, the True Finns Party, and still in the EU, but somewhat different context, in the former Warsaw Pact, one has similar parties in Poland and Hungary and Czechia and Slovakia. They combine anti-immigration and anti-Islamic messages, and these messages are resonating. If you took a chart of these parties, basically none of them existed 20 years ago, with the exception of the National Front in France. Many of them just came into existence. The AfD in Germany is 4 or 5 years old. Others, like Vlaams Belang and League and the Northern League in Italy, were regional parties looking to enhance an ethnic group or region that have still that in the background but are now focused on immigration. The two countries that notably do not have such parties are Britain and Spain. These parties have grown stronger. Now, they have many differences, of course, but what they have in common are a few things. First, many of them have neo-fascist backgrounds. Many of them are amateurish, with no end of drama, of splits, and hurling of epithets, and so forth. Many of them have, as befits a neo-fascist background, anti-Semitic elements, members, ideas. They often have dubious economic theories, a tendency to focus on conspiracy theories. Ignorance of Islam, great big generalizations that are not correct. But at the same time, I would point out to you that there are changes taking place. The parties that begin ignorant and anti-Semitic and amateurish are growing more sophisticated, are getting governing experience at generally low levels, get elected a mayor in some town, and are seeking respectability. Perhaps a most illustrative example would be the Le Pen family. Jean-Marie Le Pen, a former paratrooper, Holocaust minimizer, founded the party decades ago. And he did quite well. In an election 15 years ago, the president of France, he came in second, and in the runoff, he got 18% of the vote. Jacques Chirac got 82%. His daughter ran again for president last year, and she got 36%. So it points to doubling in 15 years. But also, Jean-Marie Le Pen is notorious for his anti-Semitism. Marine Le Pen, his daughter, has not only gone to Israel and not only made pro-Jewish statements and gone on Jewish radio and so forth, but she threw her father out of the party because of his anti-Semitism. He's no longer a member of the party. He was the honored founder. No longer. Gone. So there is this move. Is anti-Semitism in Israel particularly delicate and important issues? For these parties to become legitimate, they need Jewish/Israeli endorsement. They're trying very hard. The party in Austria called for the Austrian embassy to be moved to Jerusalem, quite contrary to everybody else in Europe. So they're changing. They still have a lot of drama, they still have anti-Semitism, they still have crazy ideas, but they're changing. It's not standard. And should these anti-immigration parties, which is my term of choice, I'm not calling them right-wing, I'm not calling them nationalists, because I don't think those are accurate descriptions, but anti-immigration parties, should they gain power, they will reject multiculturalism, they will cut back on immigration, they will encourage repatriation of immigrants, they will support Christian institutions, they will increase indigenous European birth rates as best they can, and they'll broadly attempt to reestablish traditional ways. Now, this topic is timely because probably none of you have noticed, but a few months ago, the first government in Western Europe, let's say non-Warsaw Pact Europe, non-former Warsaw Pact Europe, came to power. There is an anti-immigration government in Western Europe, Austria. The election was in October. The Conservative Party, the traditional Conservative Party, the legacy Conservative Party got 31.5% of the vote. The hot-headed anti-immigration party that was founded by an ex-Nazi got 26% of the vote. Together, they have, call it 58% of the vote, and on December 18th, they formed the government of Austria. They've been in power for 2 months. It's too early to say much about them. I'm actually going there next month to learn more about it. I think this is a major event. Austria is not a country many of us follow much. It has a small population. It doesn't tend to be the leader in many things, but I think this is important. What happened there with the legacy Conservative Party, called the People's Party, is that a new leader took over, the famously young Sebastian Kurz, who's all of 32, and he moved the party towards anti-immigration policies. And as a result, the party did much better than previously. At the same time, the anti-immigration party, the Freedom Party, cleansed itself of some of its bad elements, and it did very well as well, 26%. Together, they are now governing Austria. I see this as a pattern that is likely to be replicated throughout Europe. The Conservative Party adopting anti-immigration policies, the anti-immigration party cleansing itself and becoming more respectable. Let's take the example of Germany, which is in flux. Why is it in flux? Well, it's in flux because Merkel's CDU lost 8%, mathematically lost 8%, which went over to the anti-immigration party. It's one for one, precise. And everybody expects that should there be another round of elections, more will be moving over. Within the CDU, within the Conservative Party of Germany, there is dissent. I think one could predict with great confidence that Merkel's successor will repudiate her open borders policy. Already you can see that the Bavarian partner of the CDU, called the CSU, has distanced itself. Already you can see that the business party of Germany, called the FDP, has started to move towards anti-immigration. You can see it's happening. They are worried that the anti-immigration party will gain. They don't want to lose votes from there. They're moving in that direction. Let me give you another example. In Sweden. In Sweden, the toxicity, the denigration of the anti-immigration party called the Sweden Democrats has been beyond what one saw anyone else. For example, a few years ago in 2014, the two major blocs, left and right, decided to work together on the key issues like the budget so that they would preempt the Sweden Democrats, who have only 14% of the votes, and make all the decisions among themselves, which of course was fodder for the Sweden Democrats to say, look, they're all the same. You know, they just vote together. They disagree on minor things. So there's been this conspiracy of the parties, all nine parties against the Sweden Democrats, forming two blocks, all adamant on keeping the Sweden Democrats out. But the Sweden Democrats have been doing well. They started with less than 1% in 1998, and they have elections every 4 years in September, and almost with mathematical precision again, they doubled their vote in 2002, 2006, 2010, 2014, ending up with 14%. Today, just 6 months from the next round of elections, the polls show them at 22, 23%. I don't know if they'll actually reach another doubling mathematically, but they're certainly stronger than they used to be. What's most important is that the Moderaten, the moderates, the bulwark of the conservative camp, have started to talk about working in conjunction, allying with, forming coalitions with the Sweden Democrats. It hasn't happened. One leader was ousted because she's raised this prospect. It's certainly not an easy transition to make, but it's in the cards. It's going to happen. The conservatives of Sweden will be eventually working with the anti-immigration forces. So I predict that this is the future, that these parties are going to come to power. I also predict that it's going to be a mess, that the policies they adopt, such as those I mentioned before, about rejecting multiculturalism, cutting back on immigration, encouraging repatriation, supporting Christian institutions, trying to increase indigenous European birth rates, and trying to reestablish traditional ways, these are not going to go over well with the Muslim populations, who will respond politically, and who knows, in other ways. There will be a backlash. I think these days, when there's relative calm, will be seen as the good old days, when things are quiet. I expect there to be more violence, bordering on civil insurrection at times and places. I expect that it's going to be trouble. The Muslim populations have for years worried about just such a prospect. Already in the 1980s, a British author, the director of London's Muslim Institute, raised the specter of Hitler-style gas chambers for Muslims. That's not in the cards, but it is more likely that there will be forms of violence, of civil strife. So I believe the prospect of everybody getting along is not in the cards. I think the prospect of Muslim domination is not likely. 10 years ago, I was ambivalent. I didn't know. Could be this, could be that. Now I know. Now I'm sure that this rejection of the past couple of decades of substantial Muslim immigration, and especially the massive, uncontrolled, walking through Europe immigration of 2015, prompted by Merkel's invitation, this is not the future of Europe. Still, we've never seen anything like this before. No large territory such as Europe has ever shifted from one civilization to another by virtue of a collapsed population, a weakened faith, and self-doubts about identity. Likewise, no people has risen on so grand a scale to reclaim its patrimony. This is new territory. So the novelty and the magnitude of Europe's predicament make it difficult to understand, tempting to overlook, and nearly impossible to predict its full implications. Europe is marching us all into terra incognita. Thank you for your interest.
So many thanks to Dr. Daniel Pipes. Here we come to questions and discussion. There are a lot of people here, and the talk's covered a lot of areas, so if everyone can be brief and to the point with their comment or their question. Can I just lead off? I think, as I recall, you recently, you wrote about a recent visit to Italy and Britain, and I think you made some comments about your observations in Britain as a visitor, as against your observations in places like Australia as an occasional visitor. So would you like to reflect on Britain and a similar society as Australia in relation to what you're discussing here?
I went, in December, I went to London, and Luton, and Birmingham. They were all interesting, but London was the most exceptional. I wish I had my photographs to show you. Two things struck me in particular. One was, if you know London at all, across from Buckingham Palace is Green Park. Green Park has nothing in it, a couple statues and grass and trees. Nothing there to attack. But Green Park is, since the Westminster Bridge attacks a couple years ago, completely surrounded by a metal barrier. The entirety of it. Dreary, depressing, ugly metal barrier. Every bit of it. With the exception of a few gates that pedestrians can walk through. There's no security there. Nobody's checking your bags. And For example, in Birmingham, I went to a Christmas market, and I had the same. I had the same gates and same protection. At least there's something that could worth defending, a lot of people and so forth. But these barriers about a meter high, gray, are in many places and are a sign of defense against jihad, even when it makes ostensibly no sense, such as Green Park. The second thing that impressed me is that while I've been to some 30, 35 Muslim-majority areas or Muslim-predominant areas in the West, including, for example, La Kemba, and in the United States, for example, Lodi, California, in Canada, Mississauga, near Toronto, many places in Europe, especially in France, gone over and over. They've always been marginal places. Exurbia, for example, in much of Scandinavia, its areas that were built up for workers in the 50s and 60s, which the workers long ago left and now are inhabited by migrants. But what was striking about London, while it has its areas like this too, and they're very large, there's also a Muslim and particularly Arab presence in the heart of the city. Edgware Road, if any of you have been there. It is astonishing. It is a Muslim street with signs, some of them just in Arabic, with establishments which have nothing to do, they're not restaurants or ethnic, but say a pharmacy or other non-specific commercial enterprises that are in Arabic. Sometimes in other languages, but mostly in Arabic. Right in the heart of the city. Not far from Buckingham Palace. So this really struck me. In Italy, what really struck me is that while we are generally aware of the troubles, say, in a country like the Netherlands or Germany or Sweden, Italy, in fact, has a much worse circumstance. And it has been unnoticed by the outside world, indeed by Italians. They don't talk about it. It's not a topic of discussion. But it has, in the last few weeks, become very prominent in the political campaign that ends in a few days, on March 5th, when elections take place. The murder of particularly one woman who was butchered to death has played a prominent role in the elections. So in places where one doesn't really think about this, it is very, very powerful. Italy is now the route to Europe. It used to be Spain, and then it was Greece. Those have been closed down, and now it's Italy. And it's transforming the country. I was in the university town of Padua. Beautiful. That's Italian towns are, Padua. I went to a park, and it was an ordinary day, sun was out, people sitting in the park. And I took a picture, which is I posted my article on the subject. It was quite striking. There was a statue in the middle, and four benches around it. And on one bench sat seven elderly Italian women. On the next bench were two African young men, three African young men, and two African young men. So it was 7-7. They were lording it over, and they were crunched together on one bench. It seemed to me a symbol of what's happening in Italy and what people, those seven Italian women, don't like. You could tell they didn't like what was taking place. And in all likelihood, the elections in 4 days will reflect what they don't like.
Is it got to be quick? So there's a question there, and then there. Okay, just
I'll just ask. Yeah. Just on demography as destinies, as a number of people observe, just a comment on the European ruling class. If we take Angela Merkel as still the Chancellor of Germany, we have Germany, France, Italy, Belgium, and a couple more which just escape me at the moment, where for the first time in history the leader of the country is childless. What does this say about European belief in itself? European demography and the focus, or otherwise, of the European ruling class on the future.
To ask your question is to answer it. Yeah. Yes, it is significant.
There's a question back there.
I'm just interested in what the Archbishop of Canterbury said the other day. Over the last few decades, we've got used to the idea of the Archbishop of Canterbury being the most sort of liberal-minded, tolerant, left-wing kind of cleric, and you've now got the Pope being a bit the same way. But he came out with a very strong statement against Sharia law, saying that this was incompatible with Western values. What does this say about what now might be happening to the leadership?
Yeah, the issue of Sharia courts is most acute in the UK. They're reputed to be, nobody exactly knows, toward 100 of them. And in theory, they only deal with non-criminal, with civil law, with in particular with family law. But in fact, there are plenty of indications that they also dabble in criminal law. And prior, as you suggest, prior archbishops of Canterbury endorsed, said, no problem, Sharia is legitimate. There's been a backlash. So I would attribute this in part to the personality of Archbishop Welby, is that
right? Yes, Welby.
Welby, who has an unconventional background, and in part to the sentiments of his flock, who are upset. So it is as one of many signs that even at the elite, the archbishop level, there is some awareness and concern about these issues.
Ida.
How significant is Europe's long history with conflict in early Islamic expansion and the Ottoman Empire leading up to the gates of Vienna?
Question about Europe's experience, of historical experience going back to the Ottoman Empire and the gates of Vienna.
The European, Middle East, or Christian Muslim historic experience was a bitter one. The Muslims attacked France, Spain and France, as early as the 7th century. I should say 8th century, really. As early as the 8th century. The Balkans were attacked in the pretty much in the 14th century. The Crusades were in the 12th century. Modern European imperialism began, was in some ways a continuation of the Crusades. And the views on both sides of the trenches were venomous. Christian Europeans looked down upon Muslims. Muslims saw Europeans as uncultured barbarians. I once wrote that imagine Eskimos coming down and dominating. Yeah, it'd be a bit of a surprise. Well, that's how the that's how the Muslims felt when the Europeans came. These northern barbarians, these people of no distinction, coming down and beating them at their own game. So the historic relationship is a particularly difficult one. And had it been, say, China that had colonized the world in recent centuries, it would have been much easier for Muslims than what in fact happened. Christian, British, French, and so forth, Spanish. It was particularly painful to be conquered by these barbarians from the north, these Christian barbarians from the north. And it made it particularly difficult to adopt European ways, to westernize. So the legacy is definitely there on the Muslim side. On the European side, it was strong until World War I. It was still that sense of being Christendom. I published a couple months ago a newspaper article on the occasion of the British conquest of Jerusalem. There have been many centennials last year, including the Balfour Declaration. What did not get noticed is that on November 9th, 1917, the British forces led by General Allenby took Jerusalem. The headlines were all about Christendom and remembering the Crusades. Unimaginable. And talking about advancing the forces of Christendom. That was the way Christian Europe saw things. But for many reasons, secularization, sense of guilt and otherwise, sense of confidence, that has disappeared. And so while some of the anti-immigration parties hark back to that, Gates of Vienna, for example, that you mentioned, is the name of a prominent website in English that's anti-Islamic. While they do, by and large, it's not a widely held emotion. It's not a prism through which most Europeans see. It could return, but it's not a prism, all that.
So our microphone's aren't working. You've got to speak up and go Richard and then Morris. Richard?
Daniel, British author Douglas Murray, in his book, The Strange Death of Europe, has a major theme that European leaders, British leaders, French, German, have refused to tackle the issue of Islam and actually discuss and be prepared for a debate about the strengths and weaknesses of everything you've been talking about tonight, which seems so incongruous when these societies are actually having an episode of appeasement with what you've just been talking about with the forces that are rising. Why has this happened?
Why has the elite not confronted this issue? I've dubbed the elite the six P's. Let me see if I can remember them. The press, the prosecutors, the politicians, the professors, the police, and the priests. Yeah. They have, by and large, been absent from the debate. They have shrugged and express that first argument that I presented to you, that things will work out, we will muddle through, we will gain from this, everything is okay. Why this? I think it's a couple of factors. First, a sense of guilt that Europe is racism, fascism, and imperialism. Europe is guilty. Who are we to judge? That in effect, these immigrants are superior to us morally. We owe them something. We are not in a position to judge them. I think it's also a distance from the issues. If you are wealthy, if you are powerful, you don't confront these issues. The hotbeds of antagonism toward the immigrants are in towns that historically voted for the left, for the communists in France, for the Labour Party in Britain, and so forth through the continent. And it is the workers who are dealing with this. And historically, they don't have much of a voice. The Labour Party today in Britain is not really a party of laborers, is it, anymore? And what one sees, for example, in France, the most major town that is governed by the National Front is a former communist seat of power. And you're seeing the switch from far left to this anti-immigration stance. So it's not what the elite is experiencing or thinking about. It's too sophisticated for that.
Morris.
Dr. Pipes, I was fascinated in your three scenarios. The third one, though, when I think of the spread of Sharia law in Europe, France, Sweden, Britain, wherever, the number of Sharia, or the number of Islamic local government councils in Britain. I could go on, but I'd just like you to expand, if you would, why we should believe that the horse hasn't bolted and it's too late to shut the stable door.
More explicit what you're asking?
I'm asking why we aren't entitled to believe this is going to be too difficult to turn back, given the breadth and depth of Islam.
So why is scenario two wrong? Why is it not too late? Well, Muslims constitute something like 6, 7, 8% of that 508 million in the European Union. They tend to be younger, they tend to be more male. If there were street altercations, they would do better than their numbers would suggest. But still, 7% versus 93, which side would you bet on? If the 93% or a substantial part of the 93% doesn't want them there, they won't be there. And what I'm sensing is a growing anti-immigration, anti-immigrant even, sensibility. And it's not pretty always. It has potentially violent, potentially fascistic qualities to it. It's not going to be pretty. So there are two ways of seeing it. One is deference and submission and giving up. The other is anger and resolution. I'm inclined to see the latter. I could be wrong, but I think the statistics that I gave you, a handful of them, of the rising sentiments suggest that this is the way to go. As I say, 10 years ago I was agnostic. I didn't know which way it would go. Now I feel that this latter trend is there, it's ubiquitous, and it's just getting stronger and stronger.
And what would be a way to stop it? I mean, can it be stopped, this, what your scenario you're talking about, or?
I don't know it can be stopped. The issues are large and have risen to the top of the priorities. I don't think it can be. But I should note, from an American and for you an Australian point of view, this is something to watch. There are lessons to be learned here. This is why I'm so interested in it. I mean, Europe is important in itself. It isn't important as it used to be, but it's still important. It's far away, but it's important. But it also has important lessons for us.
There's a question right up the back. Oh, no, we don't have a lot of time. We're finishing soon. Yeah.
The Jewish community has been particularly adversely affected by this immigration. It's interesting that the Israeli government is doing much to try to convince European leaders to take more effective measures to address the Islamic threat.
It says, position is the Jewish community in Europe has been particularly adversely affected, and what, if anything, is the Israeli government saying to European governments about this?
So far as I know, the Israeli government has not taken a stand on this. It has seen this as an opportunity to welcome the Jewish population of Europe. In particular, Netanyahu, in the aftermath, I think it was the Hipper Kasher, Charlie Hebdo attack, in which he said, "You see, Jews of France, you have a home here." Got quite a bit of controversy. No, I don't think there has been. What the Israeli government has done is stay away from the anti-immigration party. So, specifically when it comes to Austria, you can look up a picture of Sebastian Kurz and Benjamin Netanyahu shaking hands. You will not see any pictures of the foreign minister, who happens to be, one, a Middle East specialist, two, a student at Hebrew University, three, not a member of the Freedom Party, but because she was appointed by the Freedom Party to be foreign minister, they're not going near her. There was just a major conference on anti-Semitism in Vienna, of all places, planned out much in advance. And it was very much under the specter of the new government. And if you look at the reporting from there, I just read an article, I think in the Times of Israel on it, the overwhelming sense is that Jews should reject this, have nothing to do with it, and so forth. My advice would be quite the opposite. They're coming. They're not fascists. They're not irredeemable. Work with them, get to know them, teach them, guide them. These are amateurs, by and large. These are not hardened politicos. These are people who are at the beginning of their careers. And they're anxious to have Jewish and Israeli endorsement. Work with them. Say you'll get our endorsement if you do A, B, and C. Work with them. But that's not what's happening today.
This lady here, just a final very quick question. Yep.
As a woman, I find, isn't political correctness rather a double-edged sword? In Europe, for instance, I mean, on the one hand, it's become a very left-wing issue, but on the other hand, looking at what goes on in certain countries in the Middle East, for instance, it's very anti-women. And, I mean, how do you feel about that? I mean, what do you see, how that plays out?
The woman issue is at the heart. If there's any single issue that gets populations agitated, it is women. And there are so many different aspects of it. As you're asking a question, what came to mind was a Swedish woman who was raped by an immigrant, and she pretended that it had been by a Swede because she didn't want the immigrants at large, and this one in particular, to get into trouble. There is a willful blindness. Europe now has such features as honor killings, FGM, burqas, female seclusion, meaning not being allowed out of the house by their husbands, that were unknown a generation ago and now are significant cultural phenomena. By and large, the elites don't want to deal with this. Hide their, you know, turn away. But it's changing. There are now...
Well, dare I say, it's political correctness.
Hang on. We've just got to finish now, okay?
As I mentioned earlier, political correctness is the name for it, but I think it's much deeper than political correctness. I think it's a sense of self, a lack of self-worth, because of this triad of imperialism, racism, and fascism. And therefore, the newcomers are better people than we are, and therefore we have to make amends to them. I think it runs much deeper than political correctness.
We could go on all night, but we won't, because we have to finish on time and you have another appointment. We're very grateful you could come here tonight and give a pessimistic, but I think a realistic assessment of the issue you've discussed, replete with factual analysis, which we always value here at the Sydney Institute. It's been great to have you here tonight. We'd love to have you back sometime in the future. But for tonight, congratulations and good luck.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.